After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. Welcome to Ramdas Here and Now, and I'm Raghu Marcus. Ramdas, in this upcoming talk that I pulled out of this enormous, wonderful archive, he talks about how may I serve you, about service. And he talks about his path being the path of service and what that means. I mean, it's a method. And there is no other better analogy as far as I know and what I picked up when I went to India with him, when he went back the second time. And that's all around this one being that's worshipped in India, the monkey god Hanuman. Now, I'm not sure if I mentioned Hanuman in any previous podcast because he comes up often in every temple of Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji, our guru, that we went to. Hanuman was prominent. In fact, Hanuman was prominent and images of the goddess, the mother, Durga, an aspect of her. And so I remember when I first went there, I mean, I knew nothing from nothing about any of these deities. And I was struck by Hanuman. It just had such a compassionate, look on his face. And of course we started reading up on it a little bit. And in fact, many of you know who Krishnadas is. And the first prayer that we learned in India was the Hanuman Chalisa, 40 verses in praise of this monkey god. And Krishnadas was the first person to learn, not easy to learn. And it's amazing that in America now, how many people, are very familiar with Hanuman and know these 40 verses off by heart. I don't know how they got there. I can't remember. It must have taken me years. Well, maybe not that long, because we used to do it all the time. And Hanuman is known in India as the perfect servant. So whenever you talk about service, he's the first to come to mind. And Maharaji used to say to us, by the way, every day, especially in the beginning, Hanuman and Christ are one. They are the same. And it's that service to man that is the essence of that teaching. And Hanuman, just to give you, those of you who don't know, I know many of you know, but I'll just, if I'm repetitive, you have to excuse me. But Hanuman, just the story goes, Ram was in the forest after he was banished by his father, and he was in the forest with his wife and his brother, and he lost his wife to the demon, Ravana, who came and captured her and brought her to his homeland in Sri Lanka. So Ram enlisted the monkey Hanuman to help him find her. So off, you know, as the story goes, off he went and encountered all sorts of adventures which showed various powers that he had. He had the power to become huge. He had the power to become as small as a gnat. And He eventually went to Sri Lanka. He found Sita, Ram's wife, and he burnt the town down because they lit his tail on fire. It's a, you know, there's so many levels to this story. It's out of the book that it's called the Ramayana. Anyhow, he gets back to Ram, and again, I have to apologize if I've told this story can be told more than once, because Maharaji, whenever he used to have this particular chapter from the Ramayana read to him every Tuesday, or read aloud, and he would be there, and it would come to a point which after Hanuman had come back to tell Ram that he had found Sita and that she was safe, and he just had to go there with his army and defeat the demon horde and save her. And Ram came to Hanuman and said, "No one has ever done what you've done for me. No one. You can have any boon in any of the six or eight universes, whatever it is." And Hanuman said, so Ram said, "Just ask me anything, anything." And Hanuman fell at his feet, at Ram's feet, and just cried, save me from the tentacles of egoism." That's pure service, love, and devotion. And he is the emblem of that. And, this is what we were introduced to when we went to India. This was the model. And of course, this foundation is called Love, Serve, Remember. And this is the basic teachings that Maharaji gave to us. And he himself, although he was a completely finished being, we would see him sitting there. Ram Dass talks about this a little bit in the talk. He would be, you could call it praying, but he would be, with each digit of his, with each of his digits and each of the lines on each of his fingers, he would be doing Ram, 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 Ram. He would be constantly in process of merging. Even though he was already that, he would separate himself out to have that experience, is my take on it. Who really knows? We would sit and watch him do this. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible to see this. And the other thing that I know Ram Dass mentions is something I myself experienced, that this being, you know, who just, when you sat with him, it was just this pure energy. There was no identifiable point, as you usually, when you meet somebody, you can feel an identifiable point, which is, you know, represents the ego that encapsulates the soul. In this case, there was nothing like that. It was liquid. And in that liquid, we would just want to melt into it. We would go there and, you know, you'd think, Jesus, I've got one question after another. How does it all work? Please tell me. And you'd get there and it would all dissolve into this liquid flow. I mean, it was an amazing, amazing thing. But that's all Maharaji was doing, was absolutely, completely one with, in service to the divine. Nothing more and nothing less. So, how may I serve you? In fact, when I first met Ram Dass in his father's farm, he would do this particular exercise, and this was the first time for me. I'd sit down and he'd face you and you'd have eye contact, and he would say, "How may I serve you?" And he talks about that in this talk, about, you know, just releasing everything of himself as he sat with a person and just would surrender into the moment and just be of whatever service he could be for that individual. And that was his practice. That was his method. And indeed, we can all take some of that on. And what else do we have to offer to anybody but is to just offer service to and prayer to, for everyone to be happy, for everyone to be peaceful. So here is Ram Dass here and now.
How do you do it? How do you do this trip? I mean, when anybody comes to see me, anybody who comes in the door, I offer them tea, I light incense, and I say to the guru, allow me to serve you in the person of the being who's just come. I feel very much like Ram's guru, who says to Ram, thank you for letting me do this thing for you, because this is my method. Das, das, das oham, I am servant. Das oham. Then I do my mantra until I cool myself out and get myself perfectly centered. And then when I can say it with full conviction and with complete openness and without being cute, which is hard because I'm a beginner and I got lots of ego. You are as hip an audience as I could ever conceive talking with. And you and I both know where we are at. And I stand, in a way, naked before you. There's no attempt to say I'm a realized being. I mean, all of this, all of the fancy halo and the beard and the dress and all the business is not to come on like being somebody else. I can only be where I am because you only teach by being the truth is directly perceivable to anybody that's listening. And I found this out a few years ago when I used to speak to people in the village or the Haight-Ashbury, places like this. I found out that the least impurity I tried to cover up sent out a vibration and everybody understood. And I could be nowhere but where I am each moment. So I have to say my mantra until I can say to the person, how may I serve you, and mean it. Because I have got to look at that person and see that that person is Ram. That person is God. Now, when I say you, it's like a technicality, and it almost feels like a cop-out, but it isn't. It's a very profound implication about who you is and who I is. It's like Ram saying to Hanuman, saying to Ram, how may I serve you? Because as long as you and I are in the illusion of duality, as long as you and I think we're different, what will be our social role? Well, our social role will be that of service. If we know who we really are, we know that we are one being. And then, as Hanuman says, when I don't know, when the cloud is there, I serve Ram. When the cloud is lifted, I am Ram. That's the way it works. And I look at another person, and all I see now, this is very hard, because everybody's the same person to me. And what I really see is more or less life, within a series of cloudy veils, which I can see as individuality. Now, I haven't lost my ability to discriminate. I can say man, woman, old, young, smart, you know, hung up, neurotic. I got all my categories. I mean, I'm a highly skilled, trained discriminator. That's how you become, you know, like an establishment man. And I'm very good at it, extremely good at it. And this doesn't mean I lost that capacity to do that by any means. It's merely a figure ground reversal such that what I look at is I just look for the light. I look for the light. And then what I am doing is saying to the light, how may I serve you? Now, if somebody says, well, you can serve me by I want you to spend 14 hours doing this for me. In other words, asking a game contract. Then we will explore it together. This is where it sounds cop-out, because I am not saying, how in the melodrama may I serve you? I am saying, how may I serve you in the journey we are on to bring us to the light? Because that's the only thing I do, is work on this journey. But within that, it might be any kind of service, because it doesn't matter. Because whatever you're doing, when you've got this model going, you're doing the same thing. When you're living in a community or in a family, when you're cleaning the behind of a child, when you're changing a diaper, when you're feeding, when you're loving, when you're dealing with a scraped knee, when you're supporting somebody who's hung up because they're so caught in their world of games, they can't see their way out, and you're just being there with them, how may I serve you? You're serving God at every moment. That's what's making life that is profane sacred. That's the operation. That's karma yoga. I mean, but those people demand all of my time. Who's them and who's I? Who's my time? What is your time worth? What are you about? Well, my time is worth $20 an hour. How poignant. How poignant. How much an island unto yourself. How little energy if your life is only worth $20 an hour. My life is worth everything and nothing. Both. My time is valueless. It's invaluable. You just can't estimate what my life is worth. What any moment is worth is every moment is an eternal moment. And if I am pure enough, it's all energy. Less hedgy but faith, you could move mountains, said Jesus. Well, if I have enough faith and I can move a mountain, boy, it costs a lot to move a mountain these days, I'll tell you. And say I can do it with a thought, and the thought takes a second. Well, look at what my time is worth. I mean, money in banking, in cosmic money in banking, all kinds of games to be played. But remember the paradox, you've got to give it all up to have it all. You see, the servant is that of surrender, the role of surrender. I mean, I go to New Hampshire, and there is my father, who has a number of hobbies. He's a very righteous person. He does lots of stuff. You know, he's always doing something. He's hammering something, or printing something, or shoveling something, or, you know. And I see he's doing things that are like, I don't know what they are. I mean, they're just things. But then so is everything else. So I come along and I say, how may I serve you? And he says, well, would you hold this? So I hold it. I went through a funny take recently. I got last fall about this issue. It gets very far out at some point. I got a letter from Nat Lerman of Playboy, and he said they had had a psychological questionnaire in Playboy about the sexual habits of men. And they wanted to do one about the sexual habits of women, and they knew, I mean, I was a really good psychologist, and would I do the questionnaire for them? Right. Now, here I am, a sexual renunciate, in a dress, I mean, just the person Playboy, you know, should ask to do their questionnaire about the bed habits of women. How may I serve you? That was the trip I went on. How may I serve you? And I knew that if I did that thing in order to bring enlightenment to the people who would take the questionnaire, Playboy would not accept it. So I wrote and I told them the problem. I said, would you ask Christ to do this? Then I said, if you had, he probably wouldn't, because he could do it. But where I'm at, I can't do it yet. Because the purest being, you see, can with whatever service he does make the purest statement all the time, because he can't make anything but a pure statement, no matter what he's doing. I mean, what is very beautiful is to find a guy who took a lot of acid and got all uptight and all strung out on amphetamines and went through the whole trip, and now you find him, and he was in the Haight-Ashbury, and he was all weird, and you were dealing with him in the middle of the night and all kinds of hysteria and mental hospitals and the drama. And then a few years later, you get a note from him. He's living with his chick in a little country town. He's the postman. Right? He's the postman. And he says, it's such a groove to go on my route every day. It's a groove to go on my route every day. Before Satori, you chop wood and carry water. After Satori, you chop wood and carry water. You mean you went through college to become a postman? But then I meet a guy who is a nuclear physicist, but a very high being who's being a nuclear physicist. And that's what is emerging very slowly. It's not that the outside drama changes. It's not that families aren't created. It's not that business doesn't go on. It's not that legal problems don't exist. It's not that society doesn't have its games and rules and laws. It's the question of how conscious are the beings that are doing it. Because if a person has surrendered their ego, then they do what is in harmony with the universe. And what does that mean specifically? What is the harmony and what is the universe? The universe is your biochemistry. It's your skills. It's your heredity. It's your environment. It's all of the forces acting upon you at that moment. It's all of the moral possibilities around you. That's all part of what the harmony of the universe is. I recall Isaac Stern, the violinist, saying to me, if I take LSD, will I still want to play the violin? I mean, I earn my bread playing the violin, and, you know, I make a lot of people happy. If I take LSD, maybe I won't be able to play the violin anymore. I said to him, Isaac, if you're playing the violin for the right reasons, you'll be a better violinist afterwards. And if you're not, you won't. Simple as that. Because everything which is impure must be burned out. Everything must. In dealing with flax, you have to let rot away all of the stuff before you've got the pure stuff you can weave with. It's all got to be rotted away, and all the impurity has got to be burned out of the system. That is the work that I am doing. It's the only work to do, as I understand it. There's nothing else to do. I mean, what I'm doing here may be useful to you and it may not be. I'm doing it as a purification exercise on myself, because there's nothing else to do but keep working on myself, because all I have to offer to any other being is my own purity, is my own being, is my own state of existence. And I realize that the less ego there is, the more there is to offer. That's the funny thing about it. The four great vows in Buddhism. However innumerable beings are, I vow to save them. However inexhaustible the passions are, I vow to extinguish them. However immeasurable dharmas are, the ways, I vow to master them. However incomparable the Buddha truth is, I vow to attain it. Doesn't mean you become a passionless bump on a lawn. It just means that all of it, all of the grooving with the beauty of it all, is done in an egoless state. In an egoless state. When you smell a flower, you are the flower. You are one. You are two and one, both at once, and there is nobody smelling the flower, and the flower is being smelled, and the savor is total, and yet there is no ego. When you are cooking food, see, in the temples, it's all designed to keep you aware of this dance. So you never cook food except with a mantra. I mean, you always have something you're saying inside to remind you that you're not just cooking food. You are doing a part of the divine process that is keeping the temple maintained in order to seek the light. That's what the journey is. What the Bhagavad Gita says, do what you must do, but dedicate the fruits of your work to me. That's another way of saying it. So there is the guru who is praying to Ram. Ram, I love you, I love you, let me serve you, whatever you want I'll do, is somewhere in him he's saying constantly. You watch his hands. I mean, there's a guy who's done it all, and he's still, you watch his hands, and it's always moving like this. Fingers are always going like these. He's always saying, Rama, 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 24 hours a day. He's going in and out of becoming one with Ram, coming back to serve Ram and love him, going back to one with Ram, out to serve him and love him, back to one with Ram. He does that with every breath. Okay? With every breath. That's how delicate it finally becomes, you see. That's how close you are to that line. Where you are God, and then you stand back in order to worship, honor, serve, love, whatever the particular role relationship is. Very egoless. The result is that the guru, to everybody around him, is pure energy. He's pure light. That's why they all hang out. That's why they can't get enough of him. I mean, I can go to the guru and I got a dozen intellectual questions and I got this and that, and the next thing I walk up to him and it all turns into liquid, it's all gone, and here we are. And boy, there's just nothing left of me. It's just pure light, pure love, pure energy. You can't imagine what basking in that it feels like. Well, you can imagine. You can imagine. Because you all do it at moments. You all do it at moments. You all get to that place inside yourself where it's all right. It's really as beautiful as I thought it was, as I dreamed it might be. There's so much light and so much calmness and so much crystal clear beauty, so much awareness, so much energy, and yet it's not that. It's energy. It just is energy. It's not energy that has to do anything. It's energy that is here. It is energy. You are energy. So when you're around this guy, he is an external personification of that stuff. That stuff. And so once you, it's not hard to surrender to that. You surrender to the light, surrender to pure energy, to pure love. It's surrender that is no surrender. See, that's the funny thing about it. The surrender concept turns out to be meaningless. What are you giving up? What are you giving up? You're giving up a kind of a hollow, empty little trip that's good for maybe another 40 years at best. You're giving it up for an eternal union with pure energy, pure light. Because surrender means you no longer die. It's as simple as that. That's what it means. Because you that lives and dies is you, ego. Is you, ego. And fear of death only comes through the brittleness of ego. Only comes through the brittleness of ego. Total surrender. Total surrender. There's no more you. No more life and death. Yeah, I'm going to die. Wow. Dig that. I'm going to live. Wow. Dig that. Garbage. Oh, wow. Dig that. The new blossom on the tree. Oh, wow. Dig that. Patterns of energy. Patterns of energy. All patterns of energy. You're part of it all. That's the place. That's the place. So, my father says to me, when are you going back to India? And I say, I'm going back. And the guru says, I am to come back in 2 years. He says, well, do you do everything he says? You hear the level of the question? Do you do everything he says? Don't you have a mind of your own? We're giving you this executive position in this company, and we want you to know you'll have a great deal of independent decision-making power. Decision-making power. What do you want to do today, Marty? I don't care. What do you want to do? I remember a few days standing in London. I had fled from Copenhagen, where we had had a very unfortunate thing with a psychological convention. And we were in London, and Tim and Bill Burrows and I were walking through the streets, high on something or other, and we were spending just days going from park to tea room to park to tea room. And every now and then we'd be at a corner and somebody would say, well, should we cross the street? And we'd stand there and nobody seemed to care. Because we were all fulfilled at that moment, right there on that street corner in London. We were all just very, very here. See, when there's no ego, the ego, you understand, is within the concept of time. It's within time. So ego always has past and future. So it's always caught in the planning, in the expectancy, in the not fulfilled, in the fantasy. While once the ego is gone, you're just here and now. It's just here and now. That's all there is. I mean, I never was until this moment, and I never will be afterwards. It's all just here and now. Okay, now we got a new here and now. Here we are. Wow, look at this. It's still here. It's still here. It's here. It's all new. Wow, look at this. It's all gone. It's all here. Here and now. Fully here and now. Right here. Right here now. Right here now. Right here now. You didn't come up the stairs and walk in and pay $2 and come sit down, come to listen to a lecture, and I'm giving a lecture, and then you go home and you'll work hard and perhaps become enlightened. That's all stuff. That's all stuff. Here we are. This is it. Right now. You don't have to have that urge, that desire, that unfulfilled thing. Just let it be. Just be. Just be. Be. Calm. Be. Be more. Be more. Be more. More. What's holding you back? Your thoughts, huh? Gotta give them up. Just ego planning. What are you doing? Planning for the future?
Well, it's hard to be now, but later, forget it.
Later. Here is here. Now is now. Are you gonna be here or not? Simple as that. But I'm so young, I have so many things to do yet.
Well, that'll sure keep you from being here and now.
Life is passing me by. But if I just live in the here and now, won't there be chaos? I mean, what happens if the telephone rings? Well, the here and now fact is the telephone rings. You pick it up and answer it. Well, somebody wants to make an appointment to see me 3 weeks from now. Right, you write it down. That's here and now. Well, what happens 3 weeks from now? Well, 3 weeks from now, there's that appointment. That's here and now. When your child comes down the stairs, this is the first moment all over again. This is Buddha meeting Buddha over toast and coffee, over milk and porridge, over moo tea and brown rice. This is here and now. We never had breakfast before. This is it. This is all there is right now. If it's not good enough, man, it's not good enough. I was taught this in a very strange way. I lived in a community in California, and I was a wheeler dealer, you see. This was a few years back. Now I'm a new kind. Now I'm a cosmic wheeler dealer. Before I settled for just like mundane physical wheeling and dealing. And I was a computer programmer. And I was supporting this community of artist-type people and stuff like that and paying off some debts. And I was a consultant in mathematics research and in public education and lecturing. And I was doing my gig and I was flying around the country being, you know, doing my thing. Speaking about LSD and... And I was living in a community. I want to digress to tell you where this first happened to me. I got to go back more. I've got to go back to 1954 when I didn't understand what was happening. That's why I didn't remember it till just now. I rented a farmhouse. I was a graduate student. I rented a farmhouse. I was living in the farmhouse and I was a wheeler dealer graduate student in those days. And a fellow called me and he said, "I've just come back from India. May I stay at your house for a while?" I said, "Sure, man. Come by. Big house. Come and live here." So he moved into the house. Every morning at 7 o'clock, I would get up and I would go in and I'd brush my teeth and I'd shave and I'd put on my tie and my jacket. And I would generally walk out. I would get into my car and drive to work. After about a week, I would walk out the door of my bedroom, and there he would be sitting in the living room, just sitting there. He might have been sitting there all night for all I know. I don't know. And I would go rushing by him. "Hi, Rob."
"Good morning."
I'd be halfway out to the car before he would have finished the good morning. And I'd just have the handle of my hand on the door and it would like stop me cold. I mean, I would see myself rushing, like caught in the next thing. And I got to hate him. I used to climb in and out of my bedroom window rather than have to go by him. Okay, now we're 10 years later and we're in this community in California and
living with a very, very high being by the name of Steve Durkee, an artist. Very beautiful guy. His wife and babies. And so I have a day off. It would be Saturday, and we'd be going to the store. Be the dog and the babies, and we'd all get on the Volkswagen microbus, and it'd be Jane, the gal I was living with, and her baby, and me, and Steve, and Barbara, and the whole scene in the microbus going shopping. And we get to the door, and Dakota, Kobe, the Steve's daughter, would say, she'd start to cry. Well, now, I have the morning free, and we're going to go to the store. Saturday mornings, we shop. All right, Kobe, cool it. Kobe doesn't cool it. She cries. Well, maybe we'll go to the store with Kobe crying. Well, maybe Barbara better stay home with Kobe. No, Kobe doesn't like that. She cries louder. Well, what's wrong, Kobe? Kobe's not going to tell us. She just wants to cry. Well, she's just being a kid. See, this is my head. Let's go. Come on. We're going to the store, aren't we? Steve says, what's the sense in going to the store? I mean, it's like, what price efficiency? What happened to the human beings in the shuffle? What happened to the vibrations in the shuffle? So, I mean, we do this absurd thing. We'd all stop around this little kid, you know? We'd all sit down. We'd join hands. We'd all cool ourselves out. And when we all got relaxed enough and calm enough, Kobe would stop crying. And then we'd go to the store. And Steve taught me that if you get so efficient that you've got to turn off the vibrations of the scene because you're so busy about the future or the past or time has caught you so much. It costs too much. Because here and now is all there is. And if it isn't beautiful, man, there's nothing. So you say, well, I can't have it beautiful now, but later when you get the food home, it'll be beautiful. Later never exists. How many people do you know now, self-made men that are 70 years old, for whom later never exists? They did it all for later, and now they're saying, I did it for you kids, and what are you doing? You're going, becoming bums, you're taking drugs, I did it all for you. And you're not giving me happiness in my old age. That's what I did it all for. I was miserable all the way through doing it for you. Time binding. Time is part of the illusion. You're in time, you pay. You pay heavily for it. Now that doesn't mean the whole world falls apart. The funny thing was, we got everything done all that year we ever had to get done. That was funny. I mean, I thought, well, when you start to play this mushy game, man, it all falls apart. You never get anything done. But what we did was so high that it was so much higher than anything I had ever been part of before, that everything we touched had a certain pristine quality to it.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate all the support for the foundation and for Ramdas's work, and we hope that you will continue that support. You can go to Ramdas.org and click on the Donate Now button and follow the prompts. Thank you.